Welcome. It is 3:19 on Friday, March 17th, and we are here with Labor and Commerce Committee. Yes, we are not Education. We are not State Affairs. We are in a different room today, and we've rearranged the – it's going to take me a little while to get used to where people are at. So we do have a quorum to conduct business. We have Representative Sullivan Leonard, Representative Stutes, Representative Birch, Vice Chair Wool, and myself, Representative Keto, and – we've been joined by Representative Josephson. We had three items on the agenda, but House Bill 79, the workers' comp omnibus bill, has been moved to Monday. And we have two bills up today, House Joint Resolution 14, the FCC increase in rural health care budget, and House Bill 132. So we will kick things off with Representative Edgman's staff, Tim Clark, if you want to come up, put your name on the record, and provide your presentation of HBR 14.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Tim Clark. I'm staff to Representative Edgman. He sends his regrets in not being able to make it here this afternoon. It's still a busy afternoon for him with
additional
obligations. HGR, well, essentially in the last few years, rural Alaska has made great strides in the long-distance delivery of health care via telemedicine. These broadband services expand locally available treatment options for an increasing number of maladies, including via treatment for substance abuse. The services accelerate diagnosis and treatment and help Alaskans avoid expensive travel for care. But we're about to hit a roadblock. The existence of such services depends on support from the FCC Rural Healthcare Universal Services Support Program. And the budget for the program has been capped at the same level since it was established in 1997. For most of the program's existence, the $400 million budget has been enough to meet demand. But as you can imagine, after two decades of advances in technology, increases in demand, and the effects of inflation, FCC now expects that in 2007, demand may exceed the budget cap for the first time. HJR 14 urges the FCC to increase the Rural Health Care Universal Services support budget sufficiently to adjust for inflation, to keep up with advances in technology and the services available with increased broadband, and to meet the increase in demand for broadband-based services in the state. Additionally, the resolution encourages FCC to index the program budget for inflation and to allow any unused funds to be carried forward to future funding years. This will allow healthcare providers in the state to continue improving access to care in rural Alaska. With that, I would take any questions from the committee, but also note that we have several people online with much greater detailed knowledge of this program who can also provide information.
Okay, thank you. Questions, Representative Sullivan Leonard?
Thank you, through the chair. Is there a state match on this particular item for telehealth for the rural areas?
Through the chair, Representative Sullivan Leonard, no, there isn't. In mm-hmm. fact, it's entirely funded through universal services charges.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions for Mr. Clark? We do have one of the individuals identified for teleconference, Jennifer Harrison. Can you place your name and affiliation on the record and provide your testimony?
Sure. This is Jennifer Harrison. I'm the CEO of the Eastern Aleutian Tribe. And I just wanted to kind of reiterate the importance of this program. It's a very complicated program as far as submitting the application, getting bids from multiple telecommunications firms, and it's quite expensive. The amount of money that we receive to receive internet for our 8 clinics along the Aleutian Islands is substantial. Without this funding, we would really be looking at possibly closing clinics. That's how much funding we have from FCC, so it's really important to us. And I just wanted to mention that our travel costs out to the Aleutian Islands are approximately $1,000 round trip. So every trip that we don't take saves us substantial amounts of money. But if they were to take LEDIS program, not all of our patients have access to travel assistance provided by Medicaid or the Alaska Tribal Health Compact. So they would have to do without higher levels of care that we cannot provide directly in our clinics. So it would dramatically decrease their quality of health. And so I just wanted to go on record to support this resolution.
Thank you, Ms. Harrison. Any questions for Ms. Harrison? Seeing none at the time, we have two other people online for questions. Colin Underwood with Alaska Communications and Vern Borner with Alaska Native Health Board. And I guess we also have John Zazda with Alaska Primary Care Association. So if anyone has any questions for them, please let me know. Although I do know they are signed up here for testimony. Mr. Underwood, do you have any testimony you'd like to offer to the committee?
Thank you. Through the chair, this is Colin Underwood with Alaska Communications. I serve as the healthcare program manager for Alaska Communications. And I just also am calling to provide testimony and support for this House resolution. I think it is important to note that the healthcare industry nationwide, in particular in Alaska, has seen a revolution in the way healthcare is provided. A number of federal laws have been passed to incentivize the digital transformation of healthcare. And while that is wonderful, no attention is being made to this program, as Jennifer made mention, that supports the vital backbone infrastructure to deliver that digital telehealth network. This resolution is voicing that support to the FCC and simply stating that it is important to also fund this while the federal government continues to incentivize and provide requirements to modernize and move to a digital platform. It is also important to continue programs that have been existing for nearly 20 years unmodified.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Underwood. Any questions? Representative Birch.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. How much is enough when it comes to bandwidth? I can remember it was a Mac something or other, probably the first one, and it had like a 2200 baud thing you hooked up to your phone, and it took forever for anything to happen. But we've got education, we talk about, you know, distance delivery for education, healthcare. Is there a point that you get to where you've got enough bandwidth into a community, how do you figure out when enough is enough?
Certainly. Through the chair, this is Colin Underwood. I'll take a shot at answering that. There's a national broadband plan that the FCC put out, and I think it was back in 2010 is when it was last updated. In there is a study that shows that a community health center, of which we have many in the state, and federally qualified health centers, the minimum recommended bandwidth is 10 megabits symmetrical. That means 10 megs download as well as 10 megs upload to provide basic health care services. What we've also seen, especially in Alaska, is a migration and the adoption of specialty care into some of these remote locations. Alaskans don't have the luxury of having many specialists in these remote locations, so many of our critical access hospitals, our community health centers, are using resources based in Anchorage or elsewhere around the state in large urban areas to provide some of that specialty care. That's going to increase broadband demands from that base level right there, with video conferencing, real-time telehealth services, those types of things. Additionally, technology is really increasing the healthcare space. X-rays, digital imaging, for instance, when you talk about that, the quality has quadrupled, at least, in quality, and that also drives file sizes. So if you're in an emergent situation and you're getting a CAT scan or an X-ray done, and it's, let's say, a 64-slice CAT scan or something along those lines, That's a significantly larger file than just a few years ago where it may have been 8 slices. The result is you're getting a much better picture and, you know, a much better diagnosis, but you need to be able to send it quickly to be able to get that diagnosis and the care you need. So I know I haven't given you a firm number, but the FCC has some minimum guidelines, and then the rest is being driven by technology demands and providing the best care in Alaska possible.
Follow up. When you say 10 megabits symmetrical, I think in Anchorage, I think they're looking at like 1 gigabyte. You know, you can, you know, put enough money out to get that to your house. 10 megabits doesn't sound like much. Is that, but that's sufficient, you're saying, for a health center?
I'm saying that is what the FCC has deemed to be a minimum standard. What we are seeing most community health centers move to now, and Jennifer, I'm going to look to you and John to keep me honest here. Many of our customers are looking to move to 50 megs, and that's just a community health center. Many of the critical access hospitals we are serving today are looking at hundreds of megabytes, and one of our customers is close to a gigabyte in connectivity. So there is tremendous demand, for broadband services to deliver these high-quality healthcare services.
Okay, and back for, lastly, to my initial question, how much is enough? I guess I'm just trying to get some sort of a sense. When you have a $400 million cap, what does that provide you? And to the extent that it's an allocation request, I mean, obviously it's a resolution, but just trying to get a sense for what's do you have a sense of what's the education requirement? It would be, or I mean, I don't know if that's a competing interest for universal service funds, or you know, I don't know how many people are drawing on the universal services, which I guess is a share of whatever we pay every month in our phone bill. But are there other competing interests for that in Alaska and in the communities that you're familiar with?
Through the chair, this is Colin Underwood, and I am familiar with the E-Rate program, the education. I also work in the education space here at Alaska Communications.
Okay.
I'm not quite sure how best to answer your question, but I can certainly tell you that the E-Rate budget nationwide is $3.9 billion, and it was just increased again this year, as mentioned by Tim, that that is a program that is being able to adjust every year for inflation. We are asking now for the same consideration for the healthcare program. Maybe you could help me understand better what you meant by competition. They are completely different. They are separate funds, and they are not competing for the same dollars. Healthcare and education are not competing for the same dollars, but they are being pulled out of the same universal fund bucket, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that's kind of what I was looking for. How big is the universal fund bucket that we're all collectively drawing on?
That's a fantastic question. I may have to get back to you on that. I am drawing a blank.
We're all paying a little bit of that, aren't we?
Yes, we are. Mm-hmm. Every month it comes out of our phone bills. You'll see something at the bottom of your phone bill. Every month it says USF, Universal Service, something like that. That charge goes into that nation bucket.
And all we're doing with this resolution is trying to get a larger share for our many needy rural communities. Obviously, is we're probably more far-flung than just about any other location in the country, I would imagine.
That is correct. We do use the largest percentage of the program, given our large state and geographic diversity and how we're spread out. There are unused funds in the Universal Service Program, and that is simply what we are asking to do, is to reallocate some of those unused funds to this program to match the demands the federal government have put on healthcare providers by saying you must transform to digital healthcare and you must integrate with electronic health records. We are simply asking that the FCC recognize those federal requirements and help support these healthcare providers by continuing to provide the best healthcare possible.
Is there anything besides healthcare and education? Is there anything else that is fed by the Universal Services Fund that comes to Alaska?
A reminder, Representative Birch, direct your questions through the chair, please.
Through the chair.
Through the chair, this is Colin Underwood, and there are two other programs. The Universal Service Fund is made up of the Rural Health Care Program and E-Rate, which we've been discussing. It is also a Lifeline Program, which is a subsidy for low-income families for dial tone service, be it mobile or landline service, as well as a program that is, I'm going to say, depending on what era you started in telecom, it's either going to be known as the High Cost or Connect America Fund, and that is typically geared towards certain telecom providers to help build out in high-cost areas.
Do we have your follow-up? I'm just trying to get a sense for how many dollars we're talking about and whether, you know, since we're obviously a lot of the rural communities that we deal with probably have needs in all four of those areas. I just was curious as to how that coordination worked. Presuming that we're looking at a healthcare component, there's probably an education component, a Lifeline component, and a Connect America component, right? I would assume so. And just curious as to how that's coordinated and how much money that adds up to if we're looking in the aggregate for Alaska through the chair.
Mr. Underwood?
Yeah. Through the chair, this is Colin Underwood. I can, off the top of my head, I can tell you numbers for rural health care and E-rate. So in 2015, the state of Alaska received just under $100 million for rural health care subsidies, and in the E-rate program is closer to $80 million. That was for the 2015 fund year. I go back to 2015 because that is the last full year both programs have been reported on. As far as the other two programs, in particular the high cost, I am unaware of just how much money is brought into the state through that program. It may be important to note that the education and healthcare entities in these communities serve as the anchor tenants to provide a lot of the backbone connectivity into those communities to later be able to provide additional services to those communities. Without those, there's not the business case to build a lot of this infrastructure out there.
Thank you, Mr. Underwood. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Birch. Any other questions? I'm not seeing any other questions. Thank you, Mr. Underwood, for your testimony. We also have John Zazda signed up for testimony. Mr. Zazda, can you provide your name and affiliation and begin your testimony?
Good afternoon. My name is John Zazda. I'm the Policy and Integration Director with the Alaska Primary Care Association. We support the work of Alaska's federally qualified health centers, also known as community health centers. 25 of our 29 members benefit from the RHC program and receive almost $38 million a year in subsidies for their internet service. We request your support of this resolution today, as it has been requested of us to seek your support in order to help our federal delegation in their negotiations for raising this cap and modernizing this program. Folks from the telecommunication industry and the community health centers are both working with the federal delegation in Washington on this program, both to raise the cap as well as to institute an inflation-proofing component for the program so this doesn't happen in the future. In talking with many of our members, they are fearful that if the cap is not raised and prorated billing comes into effect, many of them will be paying, moving from paying around $500 a month now to $5,000 or $10,000 a month for their internet service, and that would very negatively affect their sustainability and their ability to serve patients. They also wanted need to share that reverting back to low bandwidth or undedicated internet service is not a possibility for providers who use a service to operate their cloud-based electronic health records to support telemedicine and have images reviewed by specialists far away. So we would appreciate your support of this resolution so that we can maximize our work with the federal delegation and the FCC. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Zazada. Do we have any questions from committee members? It doesn't look like it. Thank you for your testimony. I am going to go ahead and that was all the invited testimony, open up public testimony. And we do have Vern Borner on, signed up for public testimony. Mr. Borner, can you provide your name and affiliation and begin your testimony?
Good afternoon. My name is Vernie Borner. I'm president and CEO of the Alaska Native Health Board. The Alaska Native Health Board is a statewide voice, through the chair. The Alaska Native Health Board is a voice on the Alaska Native health issues statewide and is a 28-member organization representing tribes and tribal organizations carrying out health services on behalf of the 229 federally recognized tribes in Alaska and works on behalf of over 158,000 Alaska Native people. Additionally, the Alaska Tribal Health System serves as a critical component of the Alaska Public Health System, providing care and services to thousands of non-Alaska Native people and Alaskan veterans as well. I would like to express our support for House Joint Resolution 14 in that it helps to improve access to telehealth and quality, to improve quality of life and access to care, to reduce travel costs and to address and intervene earlier at lower costs and with greater success. As some of the testimony has already provided, and listening to the testimony, the January 28th, 2016 broadband progress report, significant improvements, but digital divide persists from the FCC. It stated that the benchmark speeds of 25 megabits per second for downloads and 3 megabits per second uploads remains a problem. And in Alaska, the divide is quite extreme for rural Alaska. In that report from February 2015, they show that 81% of rural areas do not have access to that minimum benchmark of 25 megabits per second, 3 megabits for downloads and 3 megabits for uploads. So it is quite extreme, and this program is very crucial to protecting the early access to care in our rural communities. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Berner. I apologize for your mistaking your name. And do we have any questions from committee members? I don't see any questions. Thank you for your testimony. We are going to leave public testimony open for HJR 14 and set this bill aside and bring it forward to the committee at a later date. So thank you, Mr. Clark, and thank Representative Edgeman for bringing this bill forward.
And thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee.
Thank you. And next up we have House Bill 132, and Representative Wool, if you wanted to try and provide a brief reintroduction of what you're trying to accomplish with the bill, then we will probably just open it up for public testimony at
sure.
that point.
Sure. You want me to sit at the table?
You don't have to.
Okay. I wasn't prepared. I thought we were just doing public testimony. But I believe this committee's heard it before, but I will reintroduce HB 132, which is a ride-sharing bill, which will provide a legislative structure for a statewide legislation for a ride-sharing to allow ride-sharing companies to come to Alaska. I don't know if I need to go into more detail about what ride-sharing is. I think we did the intro last time.
Okay,
basically, it's for TNCs, Transportation Network Companies, to work in Alaska.
Thank you. We do have actually one invited testimony individual, Michael Farron with the Mercatus Center at George Mason University, to talk about the local control issue. Mr. Farron, can you place your name and affiliation on the record and begin your testimony, please?
Through the chair. Thank you. My name is Michael Farron. I'm a research fellow at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University outside of Washington, D.C.
Thank you. And do you have any comments, or are you prepared just to answer questions about local control?
Yes, I have some comments, and then you should have gotten written testimony that I submitted earlier today as well.
Okay. I do see that in front of us. Thank you. Go ahead.
Sure. Through the chair. Thank you, Chairman Keto, Vice Chairman Wool, and members of Alaska House Labor and Service, Labor and Commerce Committee. I spend most of my time doing research in my office, so I really relish the chance to get out and actually talk to people about it, even if I happen to still be in my office while I'm doing it. My research on the sharing economy over the past few years has focused on the idea of government-granted privilege. Government-granted privilege occurs when special interest groups use cronyism to try to get regulations passed for their own benefit. This hurts everyday people by limiting their opportunities for better jobs, and it slows down economic growth. One of the questions that often comes up in this research is, what is the best rulemaking authority level? Is it local government, is it state government, or is it national government? In most cases, I think local governments are actually the best rulemaking authority level because they can create more nuanced regulations and therefore avoid unintended consequences. But in some situations, local regulations are more likely to be captured by special interests or by the regulated industries. And in this case, better regulations may come from the state level instead. The written testimony that I've submitted provides my analysis of HB 132, and what I'd like to do is spend my time here discussing probably the most controversial part of the bill, the preemption of local municipalities from creating their own TNC regulations. But actually, what I'd like to do is discuss something even more radical, and that is the preemption of all for-hire transportation regulations. Michigan has actually already taken this approach with legislation passed last December, and both Texas and California are currently considering creating their own statewide taxi regulations, which is something that Pennsylvania has had for a long time. I'm in favor of this kind of preemption for three reasons. First, transportation services like taxis often cross municipal boundaries. They're not brick-and-mortar stores that never move. So in that sense, it makes sense for the state to regulate them. There's also an extremely long and sordid history, even, of taxi regulations being captured by local taxi special interests. And third, preemption essentially absolves local policymakers from having to deal with the problem, which means that better and more sustainable solutions can actually be created. So addressing the first point, that state-level regulations make sense for transportation services because they cross municipal boundaries. I recently wrote an op-ed for Everett Washington cautioning them against requiring a city business permit in the proposed combined taxi and TNC regulations. This is because if every municipality in Snohomish County created its own taxi regulations, a taxi driver would have to have literally dozens of different local licenses just to provide service in a single county. This approach essentially can create miniature taxi fiefdoms in every town because the city-specific regulations create barriers to entry, and the fewer number of local firms end up having some degree of monopoly power. And the result from that is reduced service, lower quality service, higher prices, and fewer job opportunities. The second point builds right off of the first, that local taxi firms often wield excessive influence and capture the regulations, twisting them to provide protection from outside competition, rather than serving the public interest. Preemption not only of the TNC regulations, but also for taxis, limos, and shuttles is a good way to solve the problem. If you look at the written testimony that I provided, there's a table at the back that surveys some of the taxi regulations in Alaska. Not every city's regulations are terribly anti-competitive, but some of them, like Alaska or Juneau or Kodiak, really do restrict new entrepreneurs from competing with established companies. Because Fairbanks and Juneau are about the same size, and because Fairbanks has relatively mild regulations compared to Juneau, it gives you a sense of the impact that anti-competitive regulations can have on the supply of transportation services. And in this case, Fairbanks has over three times the number of taxi permits compared to Juneau, about 226 to 71. Looking at this another way, Anchorage is about 10 times the size of Fairbanks, yet Fairbanks has more taxis than Anchorage does. If you applied the taxi driver to population ratio that exists in Fairbanks to Anchorage, Anchorage would have over 2,000 taxi drivers instead of the 188 taxis it actually has because of the medallions that exist there. And this is a serious problem for Anchorage because it means people that really need service aren't getting it. That isn't just people who need a drive home from the bar at the end of the night, though obviously that's really important. It's also important to people with disabilities. And that's why what the Anchorage City Council did last December, after great difficulty and years of struggle, finally passing a measure that allows for a mild expansion in the number of taxi medallions, is really important because part of that expansion is specific wheelchair accessible taxis. But because of the local taxi special interests, and this is kind of where the whole long sorted history of taxi regulations that have been captured comes in, the taxi interests have put on the April 4th ballot a measure that would repeal the change and essentially keep their market closed and protected. So, and third, preemption is a good idea when it helps local leaders deal with these competing local interests. Obviously, local policymakers want to serve their constituents in the right way, but they face a lot of strong pressure to maintain the status quo by the taxi special interests. So what state preemption does is it allows these local leaders to essentially rail against the overbearing state authority that's stealing away their power, but at the same time being secretly pleased that the problem's being solved, and honestly, it's not their problem anymore. So, in summary, there's three reasons why Alaska should consider state preemption of all for-hire transportation services. Because transportation services cross municipal boundaries, because for-hire regulations have consistently been captured by local special interest groups to the detriment of local citizens, and because it gives local policymakers a way to escape the special interest pressure that traps them. Preemption is an idea that Michigan and Pennsylvania have already implemented, and that California and Texas are currently considering, and Alaska should consider if it's wise to do the same. Thanks so much for your time. I'm happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you, Mr. Farron. We do have a question from Representative Josephson.
Thank you, Chairman Kito. Mr. Farron, my concern with this legislation doesn't so much concern the protection of taxi cabs. In fact, I'm as indifferent about that as I could be indifferent about anything in my life. Maybe that's an overstatement, but I just don't have a strong opinion about that discrete issue. Mind you, I will say that, you know, we don't really have, except maybe Kenai Soldotna, we don't have lots of Minneapolis next to St. Paul types of local governments. It's just too big of a state for that sort of phenomenon. But what I hear you, your thesis seems to be the state should regulate, the local governments shouldn't. My concern with the bill isn't really doesn't relate to those issues. It relates to the rights of the drivers. Are you taking any position? And I'll give you an example. Unless I misread this, a couple months ago, the Federal Trade Commission fined Uber $20 million for saying for advertising that its drivers would make $90,000 a year, when in fact nothing like that generally happens. And I think in the end there was an agreement not to litigate it. So I have those kinds of concerns, not the concerns you raise. So my question, I know that's a large buildup, but my question is, you're not saying that TNCs are perfect institutions. You're saying merely that states should regulate them and cities shouldn't. Is that what I'm hearing?
Through the chair, this is Michael Farron. Yes, sir. That is actually a good way to put it. And the way that I would argue for it is that in terms of regulating TNCs, the state should be equally as careful in terms of avoiding the situation to create government-granted privilege for the existing TNCs, because that is a problem just as much as creating government-granted privilege for local taxi merchants. One of the things that I really like about Alaska's proposed TNC regulations compared to what exists in many states throughout the U.S. right now is that they haven't enshrined the current business model of Uber or Lyft into the regulations. They're relatively open, and they say this is what you need to do, but they don't tell them how to do it, and that allows for other TNCs to come in and to compete. And so what you might end up with is a Alaska-specific TNC that knows the special needs of Alaska citizens better than the TNCs coming in from outside.
Follow up? No. Thank you. Thank you, Representative Sullivan Leonard.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Michael, thank you so much for providing information here for the members. I'm just curious as to how you were invited to provide this type of research to our committee. Is this something that you were paid to do, or is it research you did for other states? I'm curious.
Through the chair, this is Michael Farron. So this is a topic that I and the research team that I serve on has been researching for the last several years. And essentially, I've been, as TNC regulations have come up in each state, I've made myself available to the policymakers in the state that are considering the regulations. This essentially has grown up through our work on government-granted privilege, because taxi and the taxi industry and taxi regulations essentially represent literally the textbook example of how overbearing regulations create situations where it's a near monopoly, if not an exact monopoly. And so Uber and Lyft and sharing economy type firms offer a new way forward, and so it's been a really interesting research topic, and that's the reason why we've been researching it, and that's how I came to provide this testimony.
Thank
okay.
you.
Okay, and just follow a quick up. Follow-up, please, sir. Okay, and Mr. Farron, it just seems like it's kind of one-sided in your study here. I mean, when you state that your goal is to communicate how these government privileges harm the economy and the very fabric of our society, I guess it just kind of makes me pause a bit. Did you have a chance to talk to some of our municipalities and get some feedback on not only the effects of the TNC coming into the state of Alaska, but then how they operate and manage either rideshare or taxicab industries in the municipalities?
Through the chair, this is Michael Farron. So I have a lot of experience and knowledge regarding what has happened as TNCs have moved into communities across the United States as well as Alaska. And what has inevitably happened is the supply of transportation services has skyrocketed, that there are many more rides being offered, and the prices are actually decreasing as well. And that is exactly what economic theory would predict would happen, that when you have a closed market that is essentially a monopolist or a taxi cartel, that when a new competitor arrives and offers rides for cheaper than the regulated prices that previously had been in effect, that you end up with a lot more people purchasing the service, and so the market expands. And what that actually means is that there are areas of New York City, Chicago, and other places that are finally seeing transportation services being offered in them, because the supply of transportation services has been so restricted by city regulations. They've only concentrated on serving the airports and the downtown areas, and they've left the low-income areas alone. This is actually a really interesting thing as well, I think, for Alaska and for rural places around the U.S., is that many small towns, you don't have enough demand for transportation services to actually have a full-time taxi company in the town. But if what platform firms like Uber and Lyft and other TMCs do is they allow people to drive as the demand exists, on a part-time basis. And so what you'll probably end up seeing in Alaska and in other rural areas as TMCs expand is provision of transportation services where none has ever been provided before.
Mr. Chairman, if I could follow up.
Follow up.
Okay, Mr. Farron, you didn't answer my question. My question was such that I wanted to know if you've had a chance to talk to some of our municipalities to get some feedback.
To the chair, this is Michael Farron. So the answer directly to your question then is no. I haven't talked to any of these specific municipalities in Alaska on this particular issue. However, I thought that the fact that I've talked with dozens of taxi regulators across the U.S. already was sufficient. My apologies for not directly answering your question, Representative.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Birch.
Thank you, Mr. Farron. I appreciate your testimony and perspective here. You know, truly, we are entering a sharing economy. I've been on both sides of the table personally on the rental side with vacation rentals by owner and Airbnbs, and I'm very encouraged by some of the developments that I'm seeing there. From a local perspective, I did serve on the Anchorage Municipal Assembly for a number of years. I was a supporter of deregulating the taxi cab industry to address some of the concerns you pointed out in your spreadsheet, 188 medallions in Anchorage and over 220 in Fairbanks, and concerns that were voiced at that time at the municipal level. Also, from the standpoint of concerns and overlap, Anchorage does include, as I'm sure you're aware, within the municipality, it's a large area, but includes the community of Eagle River to the north, and a fairly substantial number of folks commute in from Palmer and Wasilla, upwards of 40,000 a day that commute into the Anchorage municipality. So there's certainly a demand there for the transportation component in one form or another. When you talk about government granted privilege, that certainly resonates with me, and it seems like the opportunity here to open up the market and engage new competitors in the business and enable folks to see who's going to pick them up and so forth, it all looks good to me. I would ask you, however, what do you see as a downside? We're looking at this all in from a perspective of this is all, I'm looking at it as a good thing. What do you see as a downside of this approach and opening up this this opportunity, if you will? Through the chair,
this is Michael Farron. That is an interesting question, Representative. Nobody's ever actually asked that particular question before. Speaking offhand, I would say that whenever you have new innovation that essentially upends the old order, some sort of disruption, it can be difficult to get through. It requires some deep breathing and saying, okay, we're not sure how we're going to do this. We're not sure exactly what the future looks like, but we've weathered it in the past, and we will weather it again. So I guess just the sense of unease of not knowing exactly what the future is going to be like is probably is probably the biggest thing that is the biggest problem, and is probably the biggest hurdle that a lot of people have to get over.
Okay, just by way of follow-up, Mr. Chairman, how does the integration of, you know, obviously you've got a skilled cadre of folks that have been, you know, some driving in the Anchorage community for in their respective communities in Alaska for a number of years. How can they be assimilated into a into this type of a framework, into a TNC type operation?
Through the chair, this is Michael Farron. So the easiest way is simply there have been a lot of taxi drivers that have just shifted over and become TNC drivers. And I think that the thing that makes the most sense is a mixture of kind of organization, of being able to do both, do street hails as well as connect with passengers through the online platform firms, which essentially are a much better dispatch system than has ever been provided. And you might say, like, well, if taxi drivers can just become TNC drivers, why don't they do that already? And the regulations in general prevent it as they stand in most cities. But what has happened is that taxi drivers, for example, at airports that might wait 2 hours between rides, instead will be having a new ride every half hour because they're matched with passengers that much more quickly. And the fact that you can get matched with a taxi driver much more easily leads more people to use those kind of services in addition to the price falling. So and essentially what's happening is you're using the existing resources in society much more efficiently. Rather than that driver waiting around with his car for his turn in the taxi queue for someone to come up, now he can be much more productive with his time and his vehicle. And obviously this is one of the things in rural areas, and in Alaska in particular, where you only have the resources available to you that are there. You don't have the luxury of being in a much more municipal area or built up area in the lower 48 where you have more resources available. So you have to make do with what is there. And so I think that this is something that offers a lot of value for Alaskans because the efficient use of the existing resources becomes so much better when you allow for this connection between customer and service provider that platform firms do.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Farron. Thank you, Chairman Keto.
Representative Justin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Farron, who funds your work?
Through the chair, this is Michael Farron. So the Mercatus Center is a nonprofit research center at George Mason University. It's funded through a variety of charitable institutions. I'm not really sure. There's actually a firewall in between the research side and the donations or development side. So I'm not certain who funds the work. Yes.
So you don't know whether the Koch brothers fund your work?
Through the chair. This is Michael Farron.
Mm-hmm.
Correct. Like I said, there's a firewall between the two, and essentially we are the equivalent of university professors doing academic research at an econ program that is peer-reviewed, double-blind peer-reviewed, so it's the highest quality of academic research, and we create our own research programs. So the firewall is there to maintain integrity in the process. So, I can't say that I know who exactly funds it.
Thank you.
Thank you. No other questions for Mr. Farron. Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Farron. We're going to open up public testimony now at 4:08 p.m. We've been asked to try and take care of the Sitka LIO first, since they are also up for testimony in House Finance. In Sitka, I have Hank Moore signed up. Mr. Moore, can you place your name and affiliation on the record? And for public testimony in general, we're going to try and keep to 2 minutes. We do have over 40 people signed up to testify. Mr. Moore? Mr. Moore, are you there, Sitka LIO?
We're here.
Okay, thank you.
Hello?
Mr. Moore, yes, can you place your name and affiliation on the record and begin your testimony?
My name is Emma Moore. I'm the owner of Hank's Cab. And I'm kind of puzzled about Mr. Ferry and some of the statements he made. Sound like he's comparing Alaska with all the other big cities down south. I know when people come to the airport here, a lot of times they're not standing around waiting because they're doing the same thing they would do for Uber. If they get prearranged cab rides, a lot of my customers, they don't have to wait because I'm there waiting for them already. And I don't understand why it's so important for him to make us sound like some other big cities where we have a monopoly over the whole town. The town I'm in is very competitive. We have 5 different businesses here. We all really work hard for our customers. And I'm not understanding why it's so important for him to paint this picture.
Mr. Moore, do you have testimony you'd like to offer on the bill?
What would I like to offer?
Do you have testimony you would like to offer on the bill, on House Bill 132?
Yeah, that's what I thought I was doing now.
Go ahead.
Well, I don't agree with the statements he's making.
Well, thank you.
I'd like to hear other people's testimonies.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Moore. I have Sig Rutter from Sitka. Mr. Rutter, can you provide your name and affiliation for the record and provide your testimony?
Yeah, my name is Sig Rutter. I have a small taxi business here in Sitka. It's on the 3 taxi. And we got cut off here, and we didn't get to hear the answer from Mr. Ferret there, whether he was being paid by Uber for his testimony or... But I'll go on with my testimony. We have an extremely competitive taxi business here in Sitka. We have 5 taxi providers in a town of 9,000 people. We don't have any problem with crossing municipal boundaries. We're completely isolated, landlocked here. And my concern with this bill is it's based largely upon outright untruths and misrepresentations. Rarely do we see a bill as misguided as this bill. The bill would usurp municipal management and replace it with a single state system aimed to promote interstate ride providers. In doing so, it would sacrifice municipal oversight that regulates taxi fares, screening of taxi drivers, eliminate municipal taxation, and it would work to the detriment of public safety. One of the misconceptions and outright lies involved in the premises for this bill is the assertion that the typical business model calls for a 25% fee for the internet provider, and then it said in one of these bills that I read, fully 75% of the profits will go to the driver. Well, I want to point out to you people that there isn't a business in the world that's 100% profit. In the taxi business, about 50% of its profit. So the internet provider is trying to grab a full 50% of the profits. If I, as a taxi driver, was to work for one of these firms as a taxi operator and pay my driver, both my driver and I would be getting a quarter share. This 25% of the gross taxi revenues is money that should be spread around this community. It's money that I spend on fuel and tires and mechanics. I spend $20,000 a year on vehicle maintenance in a local shop here.
Mr. Rutter, can you wrap up your testimony, please?
When you go take 25% of the profit out of a business and leave the people doing the business with nothing but the bills, you're not promoting public safety, because the first thing people are going to skimp on, is vehicle maintenance. They're not going to buy a set of tires.
Mr. Rutter, we do have over 40 people signed up to testify, and I have allotted 2 minutes for every individual, please.
Michael Ferrick got about 45 to 50 minutes there. And, this is a really snazzy presentation that they're putting on, but what do they pay you people to participate in this? This is a no-brainer.
Mr. Rutter, please be respectful with your comments.
It's hard to be respectful of people pandering to out-of-state corporate interests.
Well, thank you, Mr. Rutter. We will go off-net now. First on the off-net is Patty Slater from Anchorage. Ms. Slater, can you place your name and affiliation on the record and begin your testimony?
Good afternoon. My name is Patty Slater. I'm a private citizen, and thank you for having me today.
Go ahead and begin your testimony.
I've had the opportunity to use ride-sharing services such as Lyft most frequently in Portland, Oregon, where my daughter lives there and uses the services all the time. When I'm there, I use the app. I'm able to see a picture of the car, the driver, the license plate, and the GPS location through these great features that they have these days. These features make me feel very comfortable and safe every time I use them. And it would be such a wonderful thing to be able to offer the citizens and visitors of Alaska ride sharing as it is available in so many other cities across the country. When people come to visit here, they are shocked that we don't have these services at this time. And I hope that we will allow these services in the future, and I feel like we desperately need it. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Slater. Jason Custer, Ketchikan Chamber of Commerce, can you place your name and affiliation on the record and begin your testimony, please?
Through the chair, thank you. My name is Jason Custer, and I'm calling on behalf of the Ketchikan Chamber of Commerce, which represents over 200 members, including private businesses, local governments, and tribal entities. I currently serve as a board member and as chairman of the Chamber's Government Affairs Committee. The Ketchikan Chamber of Commerce Board of Directors voted to support passage of House Bill 132 as written, which specifies free market competition regulated on the state level. None of our directors voted against this position. We welcome ride-sharing services within our community and believe these businesses deserve a fair, predictable, and consistent investment environment in Alaska in which they can compete to do business. Ride-sharing creates more flexible transportation opportunities in our community. It creates more diverse, flexible employment options. Tourists and visitors now desire and expect ride-sharing to be available in the communities they visit, much as they expect internet access and cell phone coverage. Ride-sharing will help support our tourism economy by keeping Ketchikan competitive with other destinations. House Bill 132 will also help our community attract and retain young professionals. Today, many people desire and even expect ride-sharing transportation options and employment opportunities to be available. In summary, the Ketchikan Chamber of Commerce asks that you please support passage of House Bill 132. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Custer. I have Ben Mulligan, Alaska Chamber of Commerce in Anchorage. Mr. Mulligan, can you place your name and affiliation on the record and begin your testimony?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Ben Mulligan. I am the Deputy Director for the Alaska Chamber. I will make this brief as we sent out our support letter earlier today to the committee members. The Alaska Chamber supports House Bill 132. We believe it provides, necessary transportation options in areas where they may not have it, but also provides competition in areas where it may be, limited, such as, Anchorage, for example, and grabbing cabs, as we heard of the level of cabs that we have, and also out to some of the more outlying areas in the municipality, such as Eagle River, knowing the issues that they have there. We also support having a consistent set of rules across the state. So in places where you do have overlap, or not overlap, well, yes, in the Metro Borough where you have overlapping jurisdictions, you wouldn't have a driver trying to adhere to, up to three different ones. So with that, I will conclude my testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Mulligan. Mr. O'Malley, Dave O'Malley, can you place your name on the record and begin your testimony?
Yes, sir. My name is Dave O'Malley. I'm a longtime driver and advocate here in the Anchorage taxi cab industry. Also, in 2015, I was the first Uber driver and stayed for the 6 months they were here. During this time, I went from listening to customers continually complain about lousy taxi service, dirty cabs, obnoxious phone dispatches and drivers.
Mr. O'Malley, we're having some difficulty hearing you. Can you slow down? Speak up and maybe slow down a little bit.
Okay, just trying to get in 2 minutes. So while with Uber, people continuously praise the service. I love it. Well, I use it wherever I go, and finally, I hope it stays, and of course it didn't. People continually refer to the cab industry right now, which of course, like you've been hearing, monopoly and cartels. I call it an extortion racket, and it's kept in business through paid lobbyists, lawyers, and once again, here in Anchorage, Dan Coffey's public relations firm, and mass political donations and local politicians. The taxi permit owners here have been paying these huge sums to keep our competition and maintain the status quo, which is continuing the increase of the value of the permits along with the value of the monthly leases to lease the permits. We drivers want a choice. I've been following this for the past 10 years, and I'm convinced that TNCs are not going to fare hearing here in Anchorage. And TNCs will be back, it's much more practical here to be on the tourism and cruise ships. And dealing with a sudden influx of people like we found with the cruise industry and major events.
Mr. O'Malley, we're having a really difficult time hearing you. Is there a way you could speak a little more loudly?
Okay. I'm just saying, I, along with most of the Anchorage cab drivers I know, do support House Bill 132 and hope you pass it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. O'Malley. Joelle Hall, AFL-CIO, can you place your name and affiliation on the record and begin your testimony, please?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. My name is Joelle Hall, and I'm here today on behalf of the Alaska AFL-CIO. Our organization represents 50,000 workers all over the state of Alaska working in a variety of industries. We oppose House Bill 132 because we oppose the misclassification of workers. The action in this bill will exclude TNC drivers from workers' comp and unemployment insurance as a special class of worker. We think this is a dangerous precedent because TNC drivers do not meet the standard of a true independent contractor. Taxi drivers are exempt under this statute because they have taken the steps to set up a business model that complies with the independent contractor status. The TNC business model does not comply with all the standards required of an independent contractor. To meet the standards, the driver would need to pay all the fees associated with insuring their vehicles, and they would need to pay the TNC app as they are fees for services required for the TNC drivers to run their business. But that is not the way this model works. In the case of TNCs, TNCs pay the insurance when the rider is in the car and provide the app to the driver so that they can monitor the driver's actions and collect payment. Independent contractors are usually responsible for the reduced cost of doing business, collect all the revenues, and pay their vendors directly. Adding TNC drivers to the list of workers who are exempted from workers' comp and unemployment insurance but fail to meet the standard of the independent contractor is a slippery slope that will open the door to other industries looking to avoid workers' comp and unemployment payments. Additionally, we impose the preemption language in the bill. Each community regulates taxes differently, as has been noted earlier today. And since TNCs are in direct competition to taxis, we feel the communities that are currently regulating them deserve the, it is only fair that they would then be able to regulate the TNCs additionally, and we think this is an issue of fair competition that each jurisdiction would need to deal with as they regulate this industry. Thank you for your time today.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Hall. It looks like we've got a question from Representative Wolf.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and through the Chair, Ms. Hall. I couldn't hear exactly every word you said, but You said the taxis are exempt, they have workers' comp exemption, so they don't have sick time, overtime, any kind of work comp. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Wohl, it is my understanding that this bill is adding TNC drivers to a list that also includes taxi cab drivers, which are exempt from workers' comp and other employment insurance, as are babysitters and jobs of that nature. So, yes.
Your follow-up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So your problem with the bill isn't that, say, TNC drivers won't have the workers' comp coverage because taxi drivers don't have workers' comp coverage. Your problem is that the who buys the insurance? In other words, who pays for the car insurance? With taxis, it's paid for by the taxi company, but with TNCs, it's paid for by the individual. I misunderstood the insurance concern.
Through the chair, I actually think my concern is the opposite of what you stated. When you're a taxi cab owner and a business owner, you pay your insurance. Your insurance is commercial insurance 24/7 when you're out driving for work. When you drive for a TNC, your personal insurance covers you while you're looking for a rider. But the minute you press the app and you have somebody in the car, the TNC is paying your insurance. That is not how an independent contractor model works. That is not in any other business model. That would not be something that would be legal for an independent contractor.
Last follow-up. So for an independent contractor, well, I slightly disagree with you on who pays the insurance coverage in the period one of the TNC, but besides that, who would you like to see pay for the insurance to be an independent contractor?
If the driver is truly an independent contractor, the driver needs to be paying this insurance. It is their business, and they are responsible for paying the fees associated with running their business.
Okay, thank you.
Yep. Representative Josephson has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think, Ms. Hall, your other comment was that what would make this unique if it was an independent contractor situation is that generally an independent contractor would in the first instance receive the fee from the customer, not in the second instance. Is that what you said?
Mr. Chair, Representative Josephson, yes. Normally an independent contractor would receive work for the fee for their service immediately, and from that fee that they've received for their service, they would pay their vendors. So they would ideally be paying for the insurance out of that, as a taxi cab driver pays for their insurance. A taxi cab driver pays for their dispatcher, which essentially the app that the TNC drivers use is a form of dispatch. So a taxi cab driver has to pay for that dispatch. In this particular model, the app is given to them, and the app is then used to collect the fees. So it's just a different model of an independent contractor than currently exists in law, and this is a half thing. These are not full employees, and these are not independent contractors. We are creating a middle step here, and that middle step is worrisome in our mind because this business model does not comply with the definition of an independent contractor.
I know we have a lot of callers, but I guess, Ms. Hall, when I look at this, I find the argument that I find the benefits of the new technology very intriguing, and I think that's sort of generally where the world is going, and that people need to sort of be in that place in a competitive market. My concern is with the drivers. Assuming there's enough insurance for the passengers, my concern at this point is pretty well restricted to the rights of the drivers and what their benefits are, their pay, their workers' comp, which they wouldn't have, their retirement, sort of all of those things. And can you, I guess my question is, do you share that concern?
Chair, Representative Johnson, absolutely. We're very concerned that this particular form of worker
is exempted from workers' compensation directly but fails to meet the standard of a true independent contractor. True independent contractors thrive in our environment all the time. Taxi cab drivers, some other drivers also meet this qualification. I was an independent contractor for 10 years. This is a vital and really important part of our economy. What we're concerned about is a worker who is being treated partially as an employee by the industry that they're working for and partially exempt, and is therefore doesn't have complete control, doesn't have dominion, true dominion. Yeah, they can decide when they go to work, but there's a lot of steps that actually, a lot of rules in the test for an independent contractor that this particular job classification does not meet. And we are going to exempt them from the protections that we would normally require of any other kind of employee. We're very concerned about the drivers. We think that this middle step that is not a full independent contractor and not an employee is a dangerous precedent for all workers that could come behind and try to walk right behind TNC drivers into this particular crack and lose their protections as well.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Birch has a question as well.
Through the chair, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Hall, have you ever used a Uber cab or a Lyft?
Through the chair, Representative Birch, I have been in one in Chicago.
Okay. And I think the testimony we've had so far is that drivers, they want a choice, and that the public generally finds the service very easy to use and have had a positive experience. Did you have a positive experience yourself?
Through the chair, Representative Birch, absolutely, and we are not disputing at all that this is a wanted service and that people like it. There is no doubt that the people do enjoy this service. Our concern is related to the creation of what we believe is a third class of worker that is not protected as an employee and not fully an independent contractor. We believe that if TNCs want to come to town, that if they're doing business in our state, they should be one or they should be the other. And they could probably easily comply with either one of those scenarios. We just would ask them to do one of those things, to either employ their workers or to truly treat them as independent contractors.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Hall. And we'll go on to Kenneth Swazer. From Anchorage, Mr. Swazer, can you place your name and affiliation on the record and begin your testimony?
Kenneth Swazer from Anchorage, Alaska. I'm an interested party. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and the committee members. My name is Ken Swazer. I'm from Anchorage, Alaska. I'm a member of the Facebook page, Alaska's Worst Drivers. We have over 31,000 members, which is a little bit over 10% of Anchorage's population. Our members post pictures of individuals parking and driving unsafely. In my 2 years as a member of this page and now as a moderator, one thing that has come clear is that drunk driving is always a repeat offender, and we believe that's due to inadequate and safe and sober transportation options. Recently, we just surveyed our members about seeing that they thought with anybody were able to come out and coach, and we got over 100 responses in a matter of minutes. We would like to say that over 80% of the individuals favored supporting House Bill 132, and so we are in full support of that.
Thank you, Mr. Swazer. Next on the list, we have Bryant Hammond, City of Nome. Mr. Hammond, can you place your name and affiliation on the record and begin your testimony?
My name is Bryant Hammond. I'm the city clerk in the City of Nome. And my office handles licensing and taxation for the City of Nome. And we are concerned by the language in Section 7, reserving regulation to the state of Alaska. Municipalities should be able to set standards and address issues on a local level, as we do already with taxi cabs and motor buses. And I would be, so to respond to Mr. Farron's 3 points, for his first point, this doesn't really apply to us. We're a 13-square-mile municipality in an unorganized borough. We're pretty isolated. His number two, we have two local cab companies and 13 total taxi cab licenses. We did have three, but one just sold to another. And while his third point, while it's appealing in, well, it's somewhat appealing that we can wash our hands of it at the local level, I'm not sure that losing control of those regulations would be in the best interest of our citizens. So in summary, I would ask you to amend the language to allow for local control, regulation, taxation, and I would be in support of that bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hammond. Next we have Stephanie Spring. Can you place your name and affiliation on the record and begin your testimony?
Hi, this is Stephanie Spring, a registered voter and resident of Anchorage, Alaska. I just wanted to call and register my support for HB 132. I think it will increase not only the safety of drivers as well as passengers within Anchorage and as well as Alaska in general, as well as I think it will create greater job opportunities for people within the state. And I also think it will allow to have greater flexibility to provide support for taxi cabs in times when we need, you know, the surges in actual, you know, drivers and support and people being lift to different locations. As well as I think it will increase the competition within the ride sharing agreement, sort of area, as well as taxi services, which will increase the standard within Alaska of driving and providing share services. And so I'd like to register my support. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Spring. Genesis Allen Lockhart, next, can you place your name and affiliation on the record and begin your testimony?
Hi, my name is Genesis Allen Lockhart. I'm from Anchorage, Alaska, and I'm just here to have a public comment on this coming to Anchorage. My experience with Lyft, I experienced Lyft in Las Vegas, Nevada, last October for the first time. The service was exceptional. I was having the fact of being able to locate my driver, call my driver, text my driver, be able to see the rating on the driver, and also it would show how far away that they were on a map. So I thought that that was really detailed, because when you're a tourist, you don't know all the parts of town, so that was nice. Also, I wanted to speak on the tour season is going to be approaching here in Anchorage, so I think it would be a really good benefit for all of the citizens and the tourists that come here to have that accessibility of using other means of transportation. I've also used Yellow Cab, and Lyft is a lot cheaper than Yellow Cab. And with Lyft, they can give you a $50 credit. So you can use the $50 credit instead of using your own money. So that was a really good advantage to try out the program. And I feel like with coming to Anchorage and other surrounding cities, that it would increase jobs. Some people are unemployed, some people want part-time jobs, so that would help people to be able to work when they're able to, because you can go online and say, I'm online, so then you can start picking up customers. And then when you're done working for the day, you click offline, so then you're not shown on the app. So I feel like there's really good benefits, and a lot of people have smartphone apps. So Lyft has an app, and it's more accessible and it's more easy for people to use. Like with the Yellow Cab, you have to call the dispatch all the time, and then with the app, you could just communicate through the app. So.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Lockhart. Ron Miller, can you place your name and affiliation on the record and begin your testimony? Ronald Miller. Okay, I'm not hearing him here. We're going to go to Fairbanks LIO now. Dave Pruse, City of Fairbanks.
Yes, thank you, Chairman Sakita, Vice Chairman Wood, other members of the House and Labor Committee. Excuse me. The City of Fairbanks is in favor of Uber, but we hereby request the striking of Section 8 of House Bill 132. I'd like to thank Mr. Michael Farron for equating Fairbanks as basically the standard for cab operations in the state of Alaska. Let me read you our standard, what we have. And our standard is based upon the protection of riders and those who are able to give them a ride. This is what our standard is. An application for issuance or renewal of a chauffeur's license must be made upon forms provided by the city clerk and submitted by the city clerk for review. The applicant must be 20 years of age or older, must be able to read, write, and speak English, must have a current state of Alaska driver's license, must not have any delinquent city criminal or traffic fines or fees, must not have had their driver's license suspended or revoked within 2 years of the date of application, must not have a conviction within 24 months of reckless or negligent driving, or driving with a license canceled, suspended, revoked, or in violation of the limitation. Except otherwise provided in this subsection, the applicant must not have had a felony conviction within 8 years or misdemeanor conviction within 4 years of prostitution or promotion of prostitution, any offense involving a controlled substance, felony or misdemeanor assault, burglary, felony, theft, fraud, or embezzlement, any sexual offense, any homicide or assault involving operation of a motor vehicle, two separate felony convictions of any type, driving while intoxicated within 5 years or 8 years of a felony conviction, and finally, refusal to submit to a chemical test. What Section 8 does is it removes the standard of safety that Fairbanks has imposed. Now, when we have an applicant is usually 95% of the time approved that day of application. We're very fast of it. If an application is not approved by the city clerk, it can come to the city council.
Can you wrap your testimony up, please?
Yes, I am now. Can come to the city clerk for, can come to the city council for review. And I thank you. We've had a few applicants who've come to the city for review. And I believe Ms. Rogers from the city council will also be testifying about those types of people. Thank you for the testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Perez. And we do have June Rogers online, Fairbanks LIO. Ms. Rogers, can you provide your name affiliation for the record and begin your testimony?
Good afternoon, through the chair. My name is June Rogers. I'm serving on the Fairbanks City Council. And yes, we are in opposition to the bill as written, but we are very supportive of the work that has been thus far in regards to the state looking at the responsibilities for this type of activity in our communities. There were several comments about government-granted privilege, but I think that our direction has been government has a responsibility to community safety. That is where our code is represented, making certain that we are approaching the best possible environment for those who are working in our community and those who are using the services. We recently reviewed an appeal that it was definitely something that was a decline, unanimous decline. And given the circumstances that can sometimes appear differently when you actually work through an appeal and talk to a person directly and receive total information about the person who's going to be transporting all the children, our grandchildren, a lot of people who came to the meeting testified that their children go to school in cabs. And so it's a very, very precious transportation that is taking place when someone is transporting children to school. So we do take that very seriously. I also hope that some of the information that was given by Joelle Hall with the FL-CIO is something that is given a good scrutiny, because I think that is in direct compliance and conflict with the state law. So I'm glad that she testified. I'm glad that we've had the opportunity to testify. Thank you very much for your work. We look forward to hearing more about this, and we will be following up with written communication to you. Thank you again.
Thank you, Ms. Rogers. And we do have a few questions for you, Representative Sullivan Leonard.
Thank you, Ms. Rogers, through the chair. I just want to check to see. So you presently serve on the Fairbanks City Council, as does Mr. Pruse, is that correct? And if so, do you have a consensus from your full council to give testimony on this with a position?
Through the chair, yes, we do. We've actually submitted a letter on behalf of the City of Fairbanks to the council.
All right, just wanted to check. Thank you, ma'am.
And a question from Representative Bull.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. June and David, good to hear from you. Are you aware that there's background checks and all other sorts of checks that have to be done for TNC drivers as well, that all the requirements that Mr. Pruse listed are equally required of TNC drivers? I mean, these people, are you aware of that?
Through the chair, yes, we are aware of that. However, the example that I bring up, it's a different circumstance when you're talking directly with the person and you're looking at more extensive records than a form that's been filled out and submitted to an agency.
Chairman, through the chair, to Representative Rule, Adam, great talking with you again. What we do is, I would say in the six cases that we've reviewed, we've granted five of them where normally they would be denied. So we're more on the side of helping a person get through something, and I don't know what the standards of the TNC is, but we would hope that they would meet our standard if this was to pass. That's what I can say. And the city council is for Uber, but we just will try and ensure a standard of safety for the riders. Thank you.
Thank you. A question from Representative Birch.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Hello, David and June. Good to hear from you this afternoon.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Birch, former Fairbanks. And how are you doing, sir?
Very well, thank you. I think Representative Wool pointed out the comparison with the TNC standards, and it sounds like an excellent standard that the community has presented, and obviously it hasn't constrained your taxi cab population, in that you've clearly have more cab operators there than the entire city of Anchorage. But have you had, or would you be able to make the opportunity to compare the Fairbanks City standard with, and I'm not familiar with the TNC standard, but it might be constructive to take a look and see what kind of match there is, because everything that you set forth there sounded reasonable enough to me.
Representative Birch, through the chair, of course we would. That's a great idea. Look forward to doing it, and we could do it immediately and give you written testimony in regards to how we believe it is positive or not as compared to our standard.
Great. Thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Pruse. Thank you, Ms. Rogers. So next we're going to go to the Matsu LIO, and then we'll come here to Juneau. So Matsu LIO, we've got Ryan McKee. Can you place your name and affiliation on the record and begin your testimony, please? Mr. McKee?
Can you hear me now?
Yes, we can hear you now. Thank you.
Okay. My name is Ryan McKee, representing myself. Thank you, members of the committee, for a chance to testify in support of HB 132. Alaska, many times, is far behind the lower 48, and unfortunately, when it comes to rideshare, Alaska is once again late to the game. We're the last state to not have legislation to allow...
Mr. McKee, it sounds like we've lost you. Matsu LIO, can we get reconnected here? Okay, so we will put Mr. McKee on wait for a few minutes, and then we'll come into the room. We've got Jared Keir with an Arrows Bar. Mr. Keir, can you come forward and place your name and affiliation on the record and provide your testimony?
My name is Jared Keir with an Arrows Bar, and I'm a Juneau resident, and recently we purchased a bar in downtown Juneau. We'll be opening in April. And I'm here to speak in favor of HB 132 and can speak firsthand as to the effects ride-sharing has on the community. After high school, I left Juneau and lived in San Francisco for over 10 years. I worked in the growing tech sector and saw Uber and Lyft grow out of a need for more efficient transportation solution. Too often before ride-sharing, I would call a cab only to have it never show up. I lived in an area of the city called the Sunset, which was notoriously difficult to get a cab. In the mid-2000s, before ride-sharing, underground, unlicensed taxi companies sprouted up in the Sunset to fill the need of neighborhood residents. This wasn't a perfect solution, but at least they would show up, and since they were unmarked, no one would wave them down before they got to your location. When Uber launched in 2010, I switched all of my business over to them. Whew. Technology had solved a problem for both customers and drivers. No longer would a driver show up to a location and not have a customer because they had hailed the first cab that drove by. No longer would a customer wait on the street wondering if their cab would ever show. You could see your driver in real time on a map, know who they were, what kind of car they were driving, and exactly when they were going to arrive. Taxi companies have had ample time to adapt to new technology and the needs of its riders. Instead of investing in their businesses and adding value for customers, I see them lobbying for continued monopolies. I think a little competition would be a good thing. As a bar owner, this issue affects me more than most. Efficient access to transportation is more often than not the difference between my customers driving drunk or getting a safe ride home. 88% of Lyft users say they avoid driving under the influence because they have Lyft as an option. 66% of Lyft rides take place during times of high alcohol consumption. Studies show that ridership increases 40 to 60% when rideshare is an option. In Alaska, my business, my employees, and even me personally can be held liable for customers' actions, even if I serve them just one drink. Please allow my customers access to safe, reliable transportation options. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for keeping it right on 2 minutes. We do have Mr. McKee back, and then we'll come back into the room. So, Mr. McKee, can you try your testimony again, please?
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
All right, perfect. Ryan McKee representing myself. Sorry about that. So, basically, as the legislation has worked its way through the various committees, one thing has really remained the same, and that's that the only people opposed to this are the taxi cab drivers or the medallion holders or the lobbyists or union people that they have hired to keep this from Alaska. The customers and users of cabs and rideshare all support this. And I'm sure if you guys have followed it through the committees, you've noticed that the paying customers are the ones that say, please give us this chance. And the drivers and other medallion holders are the ones saying, no, we do not want this, this option for our customers. And so I would really, that's one thing that I really hope that you guys take away. And I understand that this is something that they would fight, but I can't see why this committee would not pass this out. The public, us have all voiced our support for this. Mothers Against Drunk Driving has shown how rideshare lowers DUI rates. And this also gives many people who may not be able to find a job a way to earn income. The facts are there, and the support from the majority of Alaskans is there. And so, again, Alaska is the only state that's not let their residents enjoy the benefits of rideshare. So I'd really ask you guys to do the right and responsible thing and move HB 132 from committee. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. McKee. We do have a question from Representative Josephson.
Well, it's first a comment, Mr. McKee. I just take note that it is possible for a legislator to, in the abstract, in his mind's eye, be concerned with drivers, drivers he's never met, who would work for a TNC, aside from any concern or belief in the right to organize or any of the other assorted protection of taxi cabs. I couldn't name a taxi driver that I know. So just please be watchful of that concern. Mr. McKee, what associations do you have? Are you speaking on your own behalf or for a national organization, for example?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, I'm speaking on behalf of myself. This has been something I've followed for a real long time. When they were here in Anchorage originally, I was real excited for them to be operating in the city, only to have them leave when the city basically required them to work to cover workman's comp. So this has been something that I've followed for a real long time. Obviously, I visit the lower 48 a lot and are able to enjoy the benefits of rideshare down there. And again, we're the only state that doesn't have it, so I really would like to see Alaska join the rest of modern society pretty much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Birch has a question as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and through the chair. Mr. McKee, I understand it's kind of a symmetrical relationship, too, and I've, you know, from my understanding of the way rideshare works in, I'm not familiar, as familiar with Lyft, but certainly with Uber, to where the driver also gets a reading or a rating, if you will, on the perspective customer or you know the person that's hailed the service.
Through the chair, Representative Birch, yes, you are correct. There is a rating system that goes both ways, and I, as again, someone who's used this a lot and has many friends that have used this, the rating system really is something that matters to both the riders and the drivers. Riders are very careful to be respectful and not be obnoxious or rude or whatnot because they don't want a bad rating, because the fact is once you get a bad rating on both sides, drivers and riders, you're not allowed to use the service if you drop below, I believe it's 3 out of 5 stars on the rating. So it is really a decent way to rate both sides, both parties.
Yeah, follow up. Yeah, that was one feature that I you know, serving on the assembly when we were discussing issues of cabs and some of the dangers and the encounters where cab drivers would come up and they had no clue who they were picking up. They just basically grabbed a fare and they piled in the cab and they didn't really have a good understanding who it was. And that was frankly one of the things that appealed to me to the benefit of the driver, is that it was a kind of a two-way street, in that the driver had a good understanding of what to expect in the way of a passenger and vice versa at some level. I mean, it might not be any more complete than a Yelp Yelp rating, but at least it was something. But that's your sense as well, I understand it.
Through the chair, Representative Birch, that is correct. It is a real good way to be held accountable, and I'm sure many people can attest to the fact that because of these and how accountable rideshare companies are, if they do have a concern, the problem is addressed immediately, versus a cab company where anybody who's had any kind of complaints can attest to this, they will just respond with the fact that they are independent contractors and the dispatch service has no way to contact them or reprimand them for inappropriate behavior.
Thank you, Mr. McKee. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. McKee. We are going to come back into the room, and I have been told that there is an individual here who is only in town today. And just for everyone's information, we are coming up on 5 o'clock. We do have this room until about 5:20, so we will continue public testimony and try and get through as many people as we can. But if we're not able to get through everyone this afternoon, then we will be having a follow-up meeting. We will continue this meeting tomorrow probably around 12:30, and I'll get that information before we adjourn or before we recess this meeting. So with that, I've got Don Creary. Mr. Creary, can you come forward and provide your name and affiliation for the record and begin your testimony, please?
Mr. Chairman and members of the Labor and Commerce, my name is Don Creary. I'm an Uber driver from Seattle. I am also serving on the Leadership Council of the App-Based Drivers Association, which is affiliated with Teamsters Local 117 in Seattle. Okay, I have driven for Uber just over 3 years. I've done 11,000 rides. In that period of time, I, like many drivers in the Seattle area, have gone from great enthusiasm about this company to a fair amount of anger and frustration, mainly due to the constant cutting of our pay, which you will experience here. There will be an initial honeymoon period where the rates will be very good, people will be very, very pleased with it, and then the race to the bottom will begin as it has done in every other city across the country. I'm just passing that on. I have two things I'd like to bring up. The issue of preemption, that's something that we have been struggling with in Washington for the last 3 years. Uber keeps trying to get preemption. We believe it is their attempt to eventually whittle away at all regulations, that they can accomplish that. I'd like to share a personal concern of mine about preemption. As a member of the App-Based Drivers Association, we have a very good relationship with our Seattle City Council. We can go to them with issues concerning us, which these companies consistently ignore. An example I'll give you, an issue that concerns me greatly and many other drivers I associate with, is parents who do not have car seats for their toddlers.
This is a very awkward situation. I have to explain to them that I cannot give them a ride. It's unsafe. It's against the law. Their response is always, all of the other Uber drivers do it. Okay, I cancel the ride. I'm sure they request another ride, and the next person comes, they give them a ride. We have expressed our concerns to the companies about this issue. The response we get is, thank you for your concern. We don't want you to break the law or be unsafe. However, you are an independent contractor. It's up to you. Okay, I am confident that working with our Seattle City Council that we are going to resolve this issue eventually. I have no faith that going through these companies, this issue will ever be resolved. So preemption would stop that from ever happening. Drivers will not be able to address their local city councils with issues which I assure you these companies will ignore. I base this on 3 years of experience. They ignore issues that drivers approach them with to a large extent. The only recourse drivers will have is going through their city councils, and preemption eliminates that. Okay, another issue, this whole thing of independent contractors. I wish I was an independent contractor. I'm referred to as one. I'm treated like one. I mean, I'm called one. But the only way in which I am an independent contractor is I do have the freedom to work whenever I want. That's great. Other than that, I work to the dictates of the company in every regard. I'll give you an example. Starting last Friday, all of a sudden...
Wrap up your testimony, please.
Okay.
I have questions.
We do have questions.
We all got questions.
Representative Will.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr.
Query. Yeah, so I'm just trying to understand. Are you affiliated with the Teamsters, or are you an Uber driver?
I'm an Uber driver, and I'm a Teamster. I'm a member of the App-Based Drivers Association, which is an association of Uber and Lyft drivers that is under the Teamsters Local 117 umbrella.
Thank you. So I'm confused because...
Sorry. No, I'm confused too, and that's why I said
I'm just confused. So my understanding was that the city of Seattle passed an ordinance allowing... organization of drivers to happen, but I didn't think it had. So is your capacity as a Teamster as an Uber driver, or is that something you do on the side?
I'm a driver who is a member of, we have an association. It is not a union as of yet.
Okay.
It's an association. We are under the Teamsters 117 umbrella.
Okay.
They advise us.
Okay, so you're not officially in the Teamsters union?
Not as of yet.
Okay, and but your affiliate, they brought you up here, I guess,
yes,
for the day. Okay, they flew you up here.
Yeah.
Okay, so you're testifying as a Teamster. You're not really a Teamster. You're an Uber driver. You've been driving for 3 years in Seattle.
Yes.
Have you driven for Lyft?
Yeah, I drive for both.
Okay, so, but you're talking about certain pay going down.
Yes.
Have you driven cab before?
Yes, I have, many years ago.
Okay, so you're still doing it, right?
What?
You're still a driver for Uber and Lyft?
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you, Representative Justison.
Thank you. First of all, through the chair, you've indicated, Mr. Curry, that are you a known critic of Uber to Uber?
Yes, I would say I probably, yes.
All right. And notwithstanding being a known critic, they haven't canceled your app.
Not yet.
Okay. And follow-up?
Follow-up.
They also said, it sounds like you went to Uber and said, look, people are asking me to carry young children without car seats. And Uber said, it's up to you. I mean, what else would they say? Other than, I suppose they could have encouraged you not to violate the law, but...
I emailed them.
Okay.
And the response was, we appreciate your concerns.
Okay.
But you're an independent contractor.
Right. Follow-up?
Follow-up.
What I'm interested in is your working conditions. So, I know and have read through the Seattle Times, in particular, recently, about the city of Seattle's concerns with TNCs. But I'm interested in what you earn, for example.
It will vary from about $600 to $800 a week for 45 to 55 hours of work.
3 years ago, I would be getting $1,000 to $1,100 in the same amount of time.
Follow up.
From the same TNC?
Yes.
And you attribute that to what? Is this
rate cuts? I was getting $1.70 a mile 3 years ago. I'm getting $1.35 a mile now.
Thank you.
Representative Stutz.
Thank you. Through the chair. So I heard you say that you drive for Uber, but at one point you drive for a cab company.
I drove a taxi in Seattle in 82 and 83.
I'm intrigued by this, whether or not you're an independent contractor or you're an employee. So I guess my question, one of my questions would be, when you drove for the cab company, how were you paid?
I would take my money home every night. I would get my money, go to dispatch, pay dispatch, and then I would keep what was remained.
And how are you paid in driving? Oh, I'm sorry, through the chair, follow up.
Yes.
Thank you. Through the chair. And how are you paid by Uber or by Lyft?
I get a deposit once a week, direct deposit to my bank account.
So sorry. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for the reminder. Follow up, please.
Yes.
Thank you. Through the chair. So you don't handle any money then? Thank you.
Representative Birch.
I was going to say, wow, 11,000 rides in 3 years. I did the quick math on that. It's about 10 a day.
I'm on the low side compared to what some
are. Is that right?
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah, there are many drivers due to these rate cuts that are doing 80 hours a week.
Okay.
Doing 150, 200 rides a week.
Again, through the chair, because I've taken a cab and transport from SeaTac downtown, although I try taking that train once in a while, but it takes forever. What's a cab fare, a typical cab fare from the airport for one person to the Westlake Center or something like downtown?
You mean an Uber or Lyft fare?
What, just any fare. How do you compare a cab fare with an Uber fare? I mean, is it like $50?
Okay, an Uber fare will be, what I will get from SeaTac to downtown, about $23 minus gas.
$23, that's the charge to the customer?
That's what I will get. So the charge to the customer will be about $28.
If I was there this afternoon, it'd be a $28 bill,
yeah.
$20 charge, and that includes tip?
That's a whole lot. You want to get into that? That's a whole other issue. There is no tipping allowed.
Again, follow up. This is very helpful because you've got so much experience. So it's a $28 fare. You put $23 in your pocket, and the what about the gas? You say you have to pay for that.
Gas, yeah.
You pay for that.
Yeah.
Okay. So you net out of $23 out of okay. I was just trying. And has that changed over time? Is that ratio again through the chair?
Follow up.
Is that you indicated that the cut and pay raced to the bottom. Was that significantly more?
Yeah, when I first started driving, I would get $30 for that same ride.
Okay. And then your proportion then changed as well? I mean, what I'm trying to understand is if they're just trying to price the ride to meet the market and bringing your cut, if you will, down proportionally, or if it's actually the share that goes to the driver is changing much.
The percentage is the same. The amount that I get is less. It's not in keeping with the market. It is designed to undercut the market.
Okay.
It's designed to drive everybody else out of business.
Okay. Okay, like that. Appreciate it. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And I guess I Representative Stutz had a question. Go ahead.
That's kind of interesting.
Let me think about it. I forgot what it was at the moment. Thank you.
Thank you. And Mr. Currie, I don't think you're the right person to answer this, but I think if you say that the goal is to drive other companies out of business, I would ask if you know of companies that have been driven out of business.
It was a cab company in San Francisco. filed for bankruptcy. I'm sorry. I forget the name of the
I guess company. I'm just cautioning. If you're making statements, we should be able to find
sure.
out if there's...
Sure. Excuse me for that. I just, you know, it's...
Representative Stutz, Representative Birch, Representative Josephson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair. So I'm intrigued, as I said earlier, about how you're paid. So... 25%. Do you have something on your app that tells you what the value or how much the fare costs?
Yes. Yes.
So you know per trip how much you're making.
Yeah.
So when you get a check.
It's on my app. Each ride is broken down.
Through the chair, follow up, please.
Follow up.
Thank you. So when you get paid, you know that you're receiving the appropriate amount for the number of trips.
I assume that I am.
Follow up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair. Well, if you have the amount on your app, can't you just deduct 25%? I mean, if you keep your own records, then you can deduct 25%, and you.
I don't have an issue with that. I'm confident I'm being paid.
I'm just
properly
curious about how all this works. Thank you.
Yeah.
Nope. Thank you.
Okay, Representative Birch.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just doing the back of the napkin calculation on the 28 to 23. So $5 goes to Uber out of a $28 fare. That's about 17.8%. So you actually make about 80%.
I get 80%.
You get 80%.
I get 80%.
Okay. So the issue, if you will, again through the chair, the issue is primarily the fact that $28 is coming down, not that your share has changed. In other words,
No, my share has changed the same. It's the rate that the passenger is paying keeps going down.
Okay.
And that is a direct cut in driver's pay.
Well, again, through the chair, if it's a competitive market, I mean, obviously, is there somebody else there's nothing. I mean, you don't have a contract. You can go find another job, right? I mean, you can go to a different employer. I'm trying to figure out what keeps you there.
Because I drove for this company at a time when it was a good job that many people enjoyed. I believe it can be that again through the efforts of us being organized. I think that we can get it back to that level. Now, I'm naive, but I believe that the good jobs that these once were can be good jobs again. Perhaps they can be even better.
So, again, through the chair, you don't have a contractual obligation to stay there.
No.
In other words, if you're unhappy with the compensation or the... But it sounds to me like the 80% is hanging in there all right. It's just that the market, to be competitive, they're probably competing with that the whoever owns the train down there, because I think that's like a $2 ride.
No, if they charged another 50 cents per mile, those people would still be going to the airport.
Would they? Okay.
These prices are low, specifically,
thank you.
To keep other people out of the market.
Representative Josephson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess, Mr. Currier, I'm just wondering, I'm convinced that the mind of man or woman could conceive of a system where everyone wins or comes close to winning. And so I'd invite you to tell me what that system would be.
Well, when I first started driving for Uber and Lyft, the consensus amongst all of us was that this was a win-win-win situation for investors, the company, the riders, and the drivers. I mean, the riders expressed to me when we were getting 50 cents more a mile, they really loved the service. You guys are making good money. This is really great. There was no concern that, like, wow, the service is great. We sure wish it was cheaper. I never have heard an Uber or a Lyft rider say to me, well, you know, the service, it's too expensive. You know, I've been often told the opposite, that, you know, you guys, you know, we don't mind paying you more. I do not believe that the prices that we are charging are market prices. I believe that we could charge higher and business would continue. It did. I used to, when I started at this job, I did less rides, I made more money. And that was the market. And it was a vibrant market. It was an ascending market at that time. In January of 2014, the company was valued at $10 billion. The rates were at that much higher level. And by August, the company was valued at $50 billion. They went through spectacular growth at a time when the rates were 25-30% higher for the passengers.
So, actually, I've been informed that, contrary to my other statement earlier, when I thought we had the room until 5:20, we had the room until 5, which means we've overstayed our welcome. Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Query, and we are going to continue this meeting. We will be meeting in this room tomorrow at 12:30, and we do have 25 people that have not yet testified, and I hope they will be able to call in or sign up to testify again tomorrow. So with that, we will recess this meeting of the Labor and Commerce Committee and return again tomorrow, Saturday, March 18th at 12:30. Thank you.